Hi, everyone. We're just letting people fill the Zoom room, so we'll be here in just a sec. Okay, so I think we'll get going. Welcome, everybody. I think you all know me, but if you don't, I'm Henry Berman from Exponent. Thanks for being here. I hope you guys are all managing to stay healthy, stay well, and perhaps stay sane during everything that's going on. Often find myself reminding people to wash their hands and, sanitize. What I have come in my own life is to also use the hand cream because my hands have become like alligators. And if I don't use both, I'm in a lot of trouble. So I hope you're managing. I also want to thank several of you have had, sent me some nice notes about these, what you're learning, what you're hearing. I've had some conversations. I love those. So feel free to keep doing those. You're wonderful. And I also hope that you're using the chat box not only to make suggestions or add commentary, which has really been terrific. There's some great stuff. I go back afterwards and read them closer than I can while we're doing this in real time. But I also hope you're taking the opportunity to perhaps meet somebody new who's floated a question or put in a piece of information that might be useful to you and connect. As I've often said, that's the real strength of our community. So there's been great, robust sharing in the chat box. And in case you're not familiar with that, my colleague Madeline is going to do the quick version of how it all works. So Madeline.
Yeah, thanks, Henry, and thanks, everyone, for joining us today. On the bottom part of your screen, you'll see an icon and below it, it says chat, and that's how you can access the chat window. Encourage you to send questions to me directly, Henry directly, pose them to everyone, comment on what our speakers are saying, and then to ensure clear sound quality for our speakers, we ask that you remain muted for the duration of the call. That just reduces background noise and allows us to hear our speakers clearly. And with that, back to you, Henry.
Thanks, Madeline. I think as many of you know, community foundations fill a special role, play a special role in the philanthropic landscape that all of us are part of. They serve as a hub for local giving, especially by individuals, but not exclusively. They can act as a resource for those who want to support a community but perhaps aren't as familiar with it or need guidance or looking for some help. And they also oftentimes work very closely with private foundations. They are not in mutually exclusive worlds. So we want to explore a little bit of that today and how community foundations, along with private foundations, are responding to COVID-19, and how all of us, regardless of the vehicle or vehicles we use, can support the beneficiaries of the nonprofits which we're supporting. And I'd also urge you to think, I know many of you are trustees or staff or whatnot at a private foundation, but many of you also probably use your own checkbook, or in my case, I'm a foundation trustee. My wife and I also have a donor advised fund and work with a community foundation or other agencies. So none of this is exclusive to simply what you're doing in your world in the private foundation. So we have three members with us who graciously agreed to come and chat with us today and share their expertise and their knowledge and their perspective. Beth Stipe is the executive director of the Community Foundation of North Central Washington. I had the chance to visit Beth probably like 3 years ago now. It's a gorgeous part of the country, of Washington State. Renee Wizig-Barrios is the senior vice president and chief philanthropy officer at the Greater Houston Area Community Foundation. And Michael Chapman is the Chief Executive Officer of the Global Center for Generosity at Cape Coral Community Foundation in Florida. So three different organizations, three different parts of the country. And so I'd like to start with Beth. And when you see Beth on camera, many of us use backgrounds through Zoom, where we'll put up a picture of, the Golden Gate Bridge. I see Clark's in front of Wrigley Field, I think. Other people will find beach scenes or whatnot. I think Beth is not using a fake background. I think she really is sitting outside on a gorgeous day. So, Beth, would you just take a minute or so and explain a little bit about your community foundation, its size, the community it serves, and your role there?
Sure. So welcome everyone to my backyard in beautiful Eastern Washington State on a gorgeous day. We're so pleased to be living in a place where we can go outside and take advantage of all the great things that we have here. We are a regional community foundation located in Eastern Washington. We sit right on the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, and we are our main community, which is Wenatchee, is sandwiched between those foothills and the Columbia River. We cover three counties, Chelan, Douglas, and Okanagan counties, which covers about 10,000 square miles and goes all the way up to the border with Canada. We are a rural community foundation, so we deal with a lot of rural issues such as poverty, migrant workers, housing shortages, those kinds of things. We are an ag region. Many of you will have cherries and apples that come from our orchards in this part of the world, and our size is roughly about $85 million in asset size.
Great. Thanks, Beth. Can you talk a little bit about how you work with your donors, and especially if there are private foundations that you're working with in your community? How's that happen?
Well, we are unique in the sense that we don't have any private foundations in all of North Central Washington. So the closest that we come to private foundations are on the west side in the Seattle area, many of whom don't fund in our region. Although I will give a shout out to our friends at the MJ Murdoch Charitable Trust and also the Perigee Fund at the Seattle Foundation, who have granted us some COVID relief dollars unsolicited. So we're very grateful to them. But for the most part, our connection is with our donor advised fund holders who use donor advised funds similar to how they would typically use a private foundation. And what we've been doing with them during this time is certainly connecting with them as frequently as possible while trying to be really respectful of the fact that we're all very overloaded with information. And so I think one of the most fun mechanisms that we've used are, as you see my backyard, all of our donors get a backyard brief every other week about the work that the Community Foundation is doing what's happening in the community, as well as thanking them and giving them some feedback on what their dollars are doing.
So I don't mean this in a legal sense at all, but I'm thinking of many of these individuals as essentially private foundations, as a private individual, and they're using you as the mechanism. So you mentioned Murdoch giving you some COVID relief funds. How has COVID, or has it disrupted how you operate, what you're doing?
Well, it has disrupted how we operate. We had an emergency grant program already in existence. We had some really devastating fires in 2014 and 2015. And so we had some learnings with how to recover from disaster. And so we fired up the emergency grant program, which was meeting every 2 months. So now we meet every 2 weeks. We've expanded the advisory committee that makes those grant recommendations to our board to include more community voices at the table. So we have voices from our local health community, the Latino community, as well as regional representation from all three counties. And we've since expanded that even further to include other, there are funders, but they're local and city and county government, as well as a regional health authority that the state has put into place. So one of the things that we've tried to do is bring together essentially a funders table. And while we all have different pots of money that some are restricted, some are unrestricted, we're able to at least collectively see the needs and to understand who's doing what, so that we're not stepping all over each other. And we are now meeting weekly in order to make sure that we're not missing anything.
Guys, I'm thinking back to several weeks ago. We had a couple of foundations in the YMCA from Frederick, Maryland. Yeah. And it was the same kind of thing where funders were getting together. Not to necessarily, violate the RICO Act or anything like that, and collude, but rather to make sure that we weren't all pouring our money to one place at the expense of another place, so that there was, we were thinking of the community as a whole. Now, I wonder, Beth, So you said you had fires a couple of years ago. I seem to recall those, and that helped, and you've learned things. Is there anything that you've adjusted to with this crisis, this disaster, that you think you might normalize going forward? Would it make sense to meet more regularly or to have sharing and monitoring? Are there ideas there that you think might get longer traction?
Well, one of the mechanisms that we put into place immediately were we implemented sector calls with our nonprofit partners. And so we meet weekly with nonprofits that are working in youth services, food security, housing, and senior services. And those calls have been really powerful in yielding both collaborative opportunities between organizations as well as funding opportunities for those groups. And it's been really helpful in our learning about what the needs are in the community, and so we're able to transfer that back not only to our donors but to the other funders in the community as well. So we really think moving forward that's something that we're going to continue to do. It may not be a weekly thing as it is now, but it's yielded such really valuable information and connections between groups who even in a small community didn't know what the other one was doing. So that's been really valuable.
I like the fact that you refer to them as your nonprofit partners, because they really are partners. If you think of an ecosystem, we as funders supply money, which we might think of as fuel, and they're the engine that's actually operating in order to move the vehicle or whatever cheesy analogy you want to make up. But they really are partners in this. And who organized those calls originally?
Well, we did.
So I think there's a lesson there that for all of us, private foundation, community foundation, whatever, that you can take on that role of being a convener of people, even if it's only to share information. Only share information. That's critical.
Yeah, and one thing I would say is, you mentioned this a little bit earlier. I think that's some value in the community foundation structure, is that we are holistic grant makers. We look at the landscape of a place based from the arts to health and human services, whereas sometimes with private foundations, they have a niche that they are interested in supporting. It's their passion, their power place. And so we can help broaden that perspective because, as you said, we're all connected, and it's very everything has its place in our strong communities. And so if we can work together more collectively, we're going to get better results, we think.
Community foundations, like private foundations, like individuals, can certainly give beyond dollars, one of my favorite expressions. Are there non-grant strategies that you're using that, again, somebody with a private foundation or just a donor individually could be using to help the community in this time?
Yeah, so we haven't seen anything coming of this yet, but we have a local person who her expertise are federal grants. She's a grant writer, and her expertise is federal grants. And so we reached out to her and said, hey, Michelle, what are you seeing? And she said, well, I'm a bit overwhelmed with 136 pages of grant opportunities that have just shown up on my desk and working my way through it. And so one of the things I think that private funders can think about is looking for those people in your communities and hiring them to be your consultant and actually put together collaborative, pay that grant writer to go after some of this federal funding to bring resources to your community that your nonprofits might not have the capacity to do individually. But if they had someone to help them, it could be really big, big bang for the buck.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Beth. I think oftentimes all of us, myself as well, we think as funders of, funding the nonprofit directly to help them with their services, whether it's to buy masks or food or whatever, but sometimes it could be helping them pay for a grant writer or pay for a lawyer to help them negotiate some government program that requires a lawyer to figure it out because it's the government. So that we think beyond what we may consider our traditional kinds of things that we fund.
So Henry, I would tack on to that, that I find that private foundations have a wealth of connections that our nonprofits may not have. And locally here, we had a bunch of attorneys that stepped up and said, hey, if you need help dealing with PPP, or if you are a business owner that is worried about filing for bankruptcy or doing some restructuring, come and see us and we'll do consulting for free. And I think a lot of our private foundations have those kinds of connections where they can, you know, nicely strong-arm their friends into helping some of the nonprofits in their community.
Nicely strong-arm their friends. So, so well put. I'm going to riff off of that and do a shameless plug for a blog piece that went up on our blog today, where I introduce a group of students, medical students, nursing students across the country who have all been sent home from their respective colleges, universities, whatever, as they have gone out in their into virtual learning. But students across the country have coalesced into a group and are available to help people in your community. And they're not looking for money. They're looking for you to say, hey, I have a grantee, and these guys might be able to be a great help to them. So I'd encourage you to read the blog. I do a very short intro, and then actually the gentleman who I chatted with, this ridiculously impressive, who's a first-year med student, wrote the piece, and there's a link to it. So this is a great opportunity where any of us can be helping our nonprofits, our communities, by simply making a connection, which is just such a powerful tool. Beth, thank you very much. We're going to come back to you. Just keep enjoying that sunshine. And let's move on to Renee from Houston. Again, Renee, thank you for being with us today. And could you, again, just give everybody a quick overview of the Greater Houston Area Community Foundation, roughly, you know, what you do, how it all works under normal times?
Sure. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for all of your interest. And like Henry said, hope everybody is staying relatively healthy, sane, and safe. The Greater Houston Community Foundation is a really young community foundation. So we're 25 years old. And we serve a massive metro area, which is arguably the third largest in the U.S. We're sort of back and forth between us and Chicago. It's about 7 million people in multiple counties. It's actually the most diverse major metro in the U.S. So we have a very large Latino population, large African-American population, large Asian population, and obviously an Anglo population. It is a community of strong dichotomies in terms of great wealth and significant poverty. And our foundation is about $750 million in assets. We have a large portfolio of individual donors who have donor advised funds with us, who rely on us for advising and grants. We have a Center for Family Philanthropy, which is nationally recognized for our NextGen Institute program for 10 years. We have been working with engaging the next generation, and we engage children as young as 5 and, of course, elders as old as 95. So one of our core ways also that we partner with family foundations is through that center. We also work quite a lot with companies and corporations through employee giving programs. And then we serve a lot of private foundations and supporting organizations. So we have about 25 private foundation and supporting org clients that work with us on a contractual basis for grant administration or succession planning or strategy work, all of that. We don't have any discretionary grant making. We do have field of interest funds. And we have been engaged in disaster relief really throughout that 25-year history. So we have giving circles and other sort of collaborative grant-making forms. And our mission is really all about positive change in the community with our donors. We made a new commitment really to data-informed philanthropy last year. We launched a major initiative for us called Understanding Houston. You might check out the website, but it is all about bringing data for our three counties, our primary three counties, and really looking at indicators so over time we can see how trends are changing and help our donors and our nonprofits really understand the community.
For those of us who may not live in Houston, Hurricane Harvey might seem like it was eons ago, but also having seen areas hit by disasters, I know that while the water may recede, the impact of a storm like that lasts for a long time. So that's in your rearview mirror, and now there's a new disaster, if you will, in the form of the virus. Is that disrupting what you're doing, or are you still in a constant sort of disaster mindset? How are these things sort of almost back-to-back affecting you?
Well, there's real positives, actually, and, of course, negatives. On the negative side, I will say, you know, we managed, I think most of you know, a relief fund of $114 million, the largest relief fund actually in history for a natural disaster with Hurricane Harvey. And while all of our grant making had been complete, we still have active grants in home repair and in behavioral health. And those have been disrupted. The home repair ones are absolutely disrupted right now because of COVID. Some of the behavioral health grant making is being transitioned to also allow for COVID patients. So there is some disruption on the home repair side. I will say on the positive side, our community is uniquely positioned to respond to this pandemic because of everything that we already have in place from Harvey. So I'll talk about it from the Community Foundation perspective and broader community. So for the Community Foundation, just from the perspective of like remote work, after Harvey, we made the decision to go to an entire laptop office. We had done so much planning about how to operate in disaster that we were fully functional within like 2 days of leaving the office because of COVID. So that really allowed us to be much more nimble. And of course, also the whole experience of running the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund and having an external evaluation from FSG and everything else completely accelerated the way we could respond to COVID. So the way we've chosen to respond to COVID is we created a local COVID recovery fund in collaboration with United Way for the first time. So during Harvey, we had multiple philanthropic funds. It was a lot of coordination, but we had the Red Cross, we had United Way, we had our fund with the local city and county mayor and county judge doing the fundraising. We had statewide funds. So one of the lessons from that was United Way and GHCF made a commitment to more relationship building in that interim and through serving together on the Long-Term Recovery Committee and really partnering on lots of efforts, we were able to pretty quickly, within a couple of weeks after the pandemic, you know, really got us into lockdown, to say, you know what, let's serve the community differently this time. Let's see if we can leverage the strength of both of our organizations to really have one local philanthropic fund so that it's easier on everyone. And we also made the determination that we weren't going to start with public sector engagement because while there were some real benefits to having the mayor and county judge do fundraising, it was also a layer of governance that made things move too slowly. So instead this time, our fund, you know, it's very much focused on serving vulnerable populations with immediate and medium-term needs, but we took members from both of our boards to be a very nimble and quick governance structure, and then we developed a grants committee made up of staff from both organizations as well as private foundations. One of the huge, huge benefits of the Harvey Relief Fund, which has translated into a new community practice, is real collaborative grant making. So I led the Harvey Relief effort as well, and we built a grants committee structure then that leveraged the knowledge of, I don't know, 7 or 8 private foundations along with the Community Foundation to make all the grant recommendations and develop the strategy. In this case, we're doing the same thing right now. It's GHCF staff, United Way, Arnold Ventures, Warren General Foundation, and the Houston Endowment. And that just allows us to do much better grant making because the level of knowledge and expertise that comes from that combined experience is really phenomenal. And because we've done that before, it was very easy to put that in place. So those things, we also had done online grant making. We had done very large scale. From the community response perspective, our nonprofits are in a different place. I mean, they've been through serving disasters. So they know how to do emergency financial assistance. They know how to do basic needs. They know how to deal with remote work in a different way that a community who's never been through a disaster doesn't. And we've been able to apply a lot of lessons learned. One of our biggest lessons learned from Harvey was the real need for coordination of social services. So we implemented an innovation in the home repair space, which was that we made every home repair grantee during Harvey participate in a coordinated intake system that we created called Harvey Home Connect, so that if you were seeking home repair, you only applied in one place. That, you know, has led to a similar system for financial assistance now in COVID, where we're, you know, we're making every grantee be in one database. So locally, we can make sure there's no duplication of benefits, and we can make it easier for reporting. And really, that had a huge influence. The city of Houston just launched their renter's assistance program, and they're doing coordinated intake with the same agency, Harvey Home Connect, that we gave birth to, which is now a supporting organization of GHCF. Wow. So many, I could go on.
Yeah. I think, you know, there was so much of what you just said, a few takeaways for me, and I think there are lessons for all of us, community foundation, private foundation, individual donor. This coordination of efforts, I mean, not only does that help the community, we've heard about that, not only does it, you know, help make sure that I'm not going to say there's equal distribution, but that all the money doesn't go to one place because they have a higher profile. But, you know, it also helps the recipient. We often talk about, you know, should we use coordinated grant applications? And I'm just talking in normal times. You know, should we have a common application so people aren't filling out multiple things? So here, and particularly in a disaster, one spot to go in, a coordinated effort for money to go out, which really requires on all of our parts, you know, making sure we take our daily dose of humility pills. I buy mine at Costco. I get the big jar. It's cheaper that way. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that it's really not about us as funders. And if there are ways to coordinate, collaborate, words like that, ultimately it's for the benefit of the community. The other thing you said, Renee, that I picked up on, and I think is really important, you talked about mental health funding. And I think both in the cases of natural disasters, you know, when the waters recede, the TV crews leave, you can still go down the street and see that there are homes being rebuilt with blue tarps on the roofs or whatever, and the disaster is in front of you. That may not be as obvious when at some point COVID gets tamed. We may see people in masks, but it's not the same kind of thing. But I think the mental health impact are things that are going to go on for many, many years. I think about post-Katrina, hearing about children who, you know, in the subsequent years, if it was just a normal rainstorm, started to have great difficulties. They thought they were going to be flooded again. And so it may not be the obvious thing to us as funders, but as we think about our communities and helping build strong communities, it's something that I don't think we can forget. And pretend doesn't exist. It's just critical. Renee, thank you. I'm going to move on to Michael, and then we're going to come back and do some stuff with all of you, so I'm not getting to all my questions, and I do want to share some more. So, Michael, welcome. We've gone from North Central Washington to Houston and now jumping over to Florida. So I think the weather keeps getting better as we go. you still win. So, Michael, would you tell everybody a little bit about your organization and your role in it and what's going on?
Sure. Such an honor to share this platform with you, Henry, as well as Brendan and also Madeline and my two colleagues, Beth and Renee. We're seated in the Southwest Florida corridor of Florida, some of the cities in our county that some of the guests may be familiar with would be Sanibel Island. We're just over the bridge from Fort Myers, Stero, Bonita Springs. We're in Lee County. About 50% of our residents are age 50 and older. So as a result of that, we tend to cater a lot to snowbirds and seasonal residents, as well as those Generation X's and baby boomers who are age 50 and beyond. Because we are a very small community foundation, seated in the community of Cape Coral, which is about 190,000 in residents, we're just shy of $20 million in assets. So coming from a big corporate foundation like Anheuser-Busch to a very small community foundation that has smaller resources and grant-making capability, you most certainly have learned the value of being nimble and being able to show value beyond our grant making. So we've narrowed our focus down to three areas primarily, which is our nonprofit capacity building, anything related to senior issues, as well as our youth philanthropy program. So those are the three areas that we pretty much focus on in our area.
Michael, as we were chatting or trading emails in advance of today, both doing a little bit of our homework, I think one of the things that really impressed me about the work that you're doing, which is, I think, incredibly transferable to all of us, regardless of your organization, is how you're finding innovative ways to add value to your community beyond grant making. We touched on it a little bit earlier. I talked about those med students. Do you want to just share a couple of the things you guys are doing? Because I think some of them are pretty cool, and they're very replicable that people could take into their community.
Yeah, thank you. So because of the fact that we are doing so much in the area of seniors, and the nonprofit that specialized in senior services came to us, and we pretty much maximized all the grants that we could give out. So what we decided to do is to take a look at what is the biggest issue that is impacting senior orphans, and through our research we found out it's senior isolation. Those who do not have relatives living nearby. They may be sitting in a nursing home somewhere, and there are a whole lot of people calling check on them. So one of the things that we did is we reached out to our local university, particularly those students who were involved in the Masters of Counseling program, and we were able to recruit over 100 students who formed a phone bank who would regularly call on a daily basis the seniors who are in nursing homes just to check on them, have real conversations, see how they were doing, just to know there's someone there to provide value. Love on them, answer questions they may have. For those who could not get out, would make a grocery run, kind of serve as that Uber driver, to bring some good eats by when they couldn't get out. So that would be one of the examples of the things that we've done.
Michael, I'm gonna hold on. I want you to keep it. I really want to underscore that. Virtually, no cost effort to anybody. I mean, I guess it probably cost you a couple hours on the phone, lining it up and getting people to do it. But what an incredible way to help your community.
Oh, thank you.
So props to you for that. So please continue.
Yeah, so that would be one of the examples. The other thing, too, we do have through our nonprofit capacity initiative, the fact that we work with over 200 nonprofits. But what we found out interesting through this process is that we have a lot of civic organizations that reached out to us, like the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis, the Gen Cs. And so, again, in keeping with showing our value beyond our grant-making capabilities, the thing that we do have as a small foundation is that we do have a lot of reputational capital, and that we do have the ability to get out on social media and rally and mobilize. So a real key asset for us here as a small community foundation would be our ability to mobilize the masses. So much in keeping with the coronavirus crisis, some of our Rotary Clubs came to us and say, a lot of people are losing their jobs, parents are being furloughed. What about the college students who can no longer pay their tuition? Could you work with us to raise tuition scholarships by simply going out to the community and getting the word out? Again, for big communities, it may not be a lot of money, but we were able to raise $35,000 to give out $1,000 tuition scholarships to help college students who could not afford to pay their tuition due to job loss. So that would be another example of trying to make the needle move beyond our grant making.
And I'm gonna interject a footnote here, and then maybe you'll share one more with us. And you said that the Kiwanis or the Lions Club, they came to you.
Yeah.
And I know from years of talking with our members, many of you choose to be very low key and fly under the radar in your community. I would suggest that maybe this is the time when you emerge a little bit.
Yeah.
You have tremendous power as a foundation, as small as you may be, as humble as you may be, to reach out and look perhaps to a community foundation to partner with them on something like this, or to reach out to people you may know to encourage them. And it's not the time to be the shy wallflower. It's the time to walk across the gym floor and ask that other person to dance, because we really need to do this kind of thing. So thanks for that, Michael. Perhaps one more.
Sure. So the other thing would be this, and we had an organization, because we have a lot of seasonal residents and snowbirds who live in our community, a gentleman had reached out to me from Georgia and specializes in benevolent funds, primarily for churches. So when people find themselves in a need and they are hungry and they go to, say, their local place of worship and they need help paying a light bill, what we oftentimes get in our community, because we do a lot in the area of senior needs and human services, people want to do things specifically for individuals. So we created a strategic partnership with an organization called Helping Hands Ministries out of Georgia. And they came to us and they said, if you have any individuals in your community who want to go under the radar, who want to pay a light bill, who want to pay for groceries, do small things, we can work in concert with your community foundation to be able to do that. And boy, has that been successful. Again, those are not grants that come through us. They're passed through another entity. But we are really excited about the fact that we were able to facilitate literally hundreds of those types of small grants, usually $100, $200, to pay small things for people who have a need in our community.
So two thoughts that come out of that. One is, you know, thinking broader beyond your own city or town or county's limit.
Yeah.
There may be opportunities. The other thing you said, Michael, that I think is really important was that, you know, the money didn't come through you, but it was benefiting the community, or it was just a pass-through. I will share a brief story from many, many, many years ago where we as a foundation were getting involved with funding a health clinic, and it was going to involve actually a corporation, a professional sports team, and the foundation. And we were all prepared to put in, you know, our equal shares. But the sports team wanted all the money to go through them, so they would be held up in the community as being the big person. And you know, it really struck me at the time as being missing the point. But the bigger point was that we were helping the community. So sometimes that's what it's really about.
If I may interject, again, what happens in our area, we are surrounded by a sea of community foundations. They're like five within an hour from where I am. And so as a result of that, being the smallest, we have to be innovative and repurpose ourselves. Not to mention the fact that the majority of our residents are not from here. So when they come to us, they make it perfectly clear, we're from Houston, we're from D.C., we're from other areas, and so their endowments are in other places. So we are kind of a secondary market for them, which allows us to do a lot of things around volunteerism and small acts of kindness and generosity, thus the name, the Global Center for Generosity.
So let's pick up on that thought for a minute, Michael, because I know we have many private foundation members who perhaps, you know, live in New York or live in Minnesota or Chicago, but spend, you know, a good part of their year and some of their philanthropic dollars, you know, in Florida, in Arizona, in Southern California, whatever. Any thoughts for those people about how they can engage with these second communities of theirs and perhaps become more involved and feel less of, you know, just that snowbird flying in, flying out?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot at the board level as well as the staff level. But, yeah, I would say yes, that we recognize you're going to take care of home, and home should come first, but also to remember your second community as well. So you may, again, unlock your donor advised funds to do some things in your hometown, but maybe take a percentage of that, maybe 10% of that, to do something in your second community. We also have knowledge, again, as in the case of most community foundations, of our nonprofit partners, what they're doing. So using us more as a conduit, as a pass-through, to know what the local nonprofits are doing, those who are effective, those who are really having the impact and making the needle move, is what we hope that some of those folks would do when they come here.
Thanks.
Sure.
I'm going to now throw a couple questions out to all three of you and feel free to interrupt each other. But before I do that, one, if there's any questions, please put them in the chat room. And also, there's some really interesting chat going on about things that you can be doing that, again, don't necessarily cost you money, but can have an impact. Things around just making some phone calls, perhaps to a government official, or other things that can happen. So for any of you, all of you, what advice do you have for funders as they look at needs of their community? Should they be thinking differently because of the virus? Should they be thinking long-term, short-term? Any observations, any thoughts, any advice you'd give them?
I think one of the things that we've been committed to that our local foundation sector has really appreciated is the need for real-time data. So yes, we all need to look long-term, but this is a historic moment. We made a commitment to share all of our data with our local grant-making forum. So we have two data projects going. One is we did a nonprofit survey a long time ago now in the middle of March to survey the nonprofit sector and find out what were their needs, how many were able to continue operating with COVID, what kind of revenue loss were they facing, how were their teams, et cetera. I'm happy to share the survey with others. We did it first with our disaster relief nonprofit so that it would form our COVID grant making, but it really has helped us understand how the sector is changing, and it's live on our GreaterHoustonRecovery.org website. We have a nonprofit needs dashboard in that, and so we shared that with the community. We also decided that, so two other data pieces, we also did an economic impact survey through Harvey Home Connect. They have a live survey that individuals can fill out about their top needs. So 3,000 individuals have completed that, and we've been sharing that with the whole community. And then on top of that, we're getting data from 211 line from United Way on a weekly basis. And then the third thing is, for the COVID fund itself, which is now about $14, $15 million, we wanted to make sure it was accessible to all nonprofits, but that we were able to do very quick grant making. So we did a streamlined LOI process, letter of intent, a nonprofit inquiry, and we've received about 400 nonprofit inquiries. So our grants committee, of course, is reading every one of those to inform who we invite for grant making. But we also have shared every week those nonprofit inquiries with our local grant makers forum. So we're trying to share all of the data that we have with the entire foundation community as well as the public sector in order to allow people to have data, because the landscape is changing so rapidly. So I just think wherever communities can come together to share that kind of data more frequently, it's going to lead to better outcomes.
So Renee, I want to ask you a couple quick questions following up on that, because as I've talked to colleagues both in the foundation world and in the foundation, other membership organizations and whatnot, is there a concern, number one, about survey fatigue and asking people when they're in they're up to their hips in alligators, is that, are you concerned about that? And then the other thing, you made the remark about it seemed like eons ago, it was in March. Mm-hmm. This is, to me, it appears like just so dynamic, the way mm-hmm. things are changing. Mm-hmm. Is the data from March valid today? And how often do you update it? And then that loops back to that first question about, are we surveying too much? And I don't necessarily have an opinion. I'm just curious because it's been a discussion point.
Yeah, yes, you could survey too much. We are not surveying too much. I mean, we did it was a very quick, simple survey, and because it's being shared with the whole foundation community, the nonprofits were all eager to do it. In terms of information getting outdated, yes, it can, but we needed a baseline from which to start. And then, quite honestly, the nonprofit inquiries that are coming in for the COVID grant making are more up to date because those are happening more frequently. There's not going to be perfect data, but I think it's better to get some data than none. I was worried on the economic impact survey, asking individuals to take it. I didn't know what the response would be. But quite honestly, that 3,000 people have done it, within like a four-week period tells you there's hunger for people to talk about what they need. So it depends a lot on the design of these things and how streamlined they are, how easy to use. Those are all valid concerns.
Yeah. Thank you. Beth, Michael, any thoughts either on the survey question or jumping back to my original question about advice that you would share?
In our community, again, because there are so many community foundations in our area, the largest community foundation is much similar in scope to what Renee is doing at the Greater Houston. So we service our community in a different way. But one of the things that our nonprofits have found value in is because so many of the workers are being let go because of the fact that they have not prepared for this type of disruption and not having a sufficient amount of operational reserves. So the role that we're playing, again, it doesn't require any money, is that we have been building a pipeline of skilled volunteers, mainly those who are age 50 and older, those retirees that come to the area, those who choose to stay, and skilled volunteers who can really step in and do roles within a nonprofit to help them until things improve. So we do have a very strong civic matchmaking program with retirees who are looking to utilize their skills inside of nonprofit organizations. And so that has been very useful to a lot of our nonprofits. And so when things open up again, we're able to match these skilled volunteers with those nonprofits who have holes that they need to fill and so they can rehire again.
So we also did a survey way back in March. I saw a meme that said that there were 29 days in February and 31 days in March and 3,000 days in April, and it sure does feel like that. That was when we implemented the sector calls because it is so dynamic and things are changing so quickly. We're starting to see leveling off at the food banks, which no one ever anticipated, but we're planning for something different. And so back to your original question about, you know, what does this mean for us as funders? And, you know, my board is stepping back and saying, this is a new day. This is a whole different world that we're living in. Are we going to continue with business as usual, or do we really need to rethink the entire model of how we do our grant making, whether that be for the next 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, or moving forward in the future? And so that's really the space that we're in now. And I would say that it's all on the table for us. We're really looking at how do we deliver our role in society better with the new needs that are evolving today.
I think that perhaps is, you know, the existential question that ought to be on the minds of every single foundation and foundation trustee. And I'm not saying that means you have to change, but I think this is one of those moments in time when you really need to think about it and be comfortable in how you're moving forward. As we look at you know, a new world, we all talk about, you know, we're in a new normal. No, we're not in a new normal now. We're in a transition to a new normal that we don't know what it will be, and also to a new normal that will be very different for all of us. It'll be different for the nonprofits. It'll be different for the beneficiaries. It'll be different for the funders. It's just going to be different all over the place. And how we all address that, I really do think is going to be one of those defining questions for all of us. And frankly, you know, this is a sector where we oftentimes talk about taking risk and failing forward and being bold. I don't expect we're all going to get it right the first time because it's also a dynamic issue that we're chasing. So that, but I think the worst thing we can do is to take inaction. We may not want to change, but we're not changing because we've thought through what we're doing and it feels right. So that's my rant for the moment. Another question for the three of you: are there ways that private foundations and community foundations can collaborate better, perhaps, or in new and different ways, particularly given the virus? Is this an opportunity to look at those relationships and think how we might support each other? Any thoughts on that from any of you? I can call on people if I
Yeah, have. No, I'm sorry. Something was coming to my front door and my dog was barking. I just hesitated for a second. I'm probably trying to see if Beth or Michael wanted to talk first. We're finding that there's more hunger for collaboration than ever before. So, I mean, we're set up for it in lots of ways because we have collaborative grant-making committees and we have private foundations that we serve. And so we have a lot of relationships. And then our Grantmakers Forum, all of a sudden wanted to discuss a transparency initiative where foundations were sharing a lot more about their grant making and being more open about what they're doing. And I don't know where that's going to lead, but it's very exciting dialogue. I know for me, I mean, you know, you build these relationships over so many years. I have deep respect for the private foundations in our community who all are trying to do good. And so we all pick up the phone all the time and call each other. You know, we're trying to decide, okay, which homeless organizations are we inviting to the grants process, or who are really serving this disproportionately impacted community. So our mantra is leveraging knowledge all the time and just constantly reaching out to each other and from a place of respect and with a sense of purpose. And, I mean, that started before Harvey, but was certainly expanded on it. So I sense a bit of a new day, not for everyone. And I think it's always important to respect there are people who there are private foundations who really do want to remain very private and under the radar and would prefer not to engage others because that is their DNA or a very specific mission. But the great majority are really open to conversation about how to maximize. And that doesn't necessarily mean pooling funds. For some people, that's very comfortable. For others, that's never going to be comfortable, and that's okay. But how do we align efforts and have really honest conversations about where we can each amplify each other's work so that more good is done? I mean, to me, I think there's a lot of fruitful dialogue and hopefully efforts that will come out from that.
Yeah, great point, Renee. And I think, number one, you know, we're never going to tell you what to do. That absolutely is your choice. Might urge you to think about stuff. But also, you know, collaboration is one of those words that I think is terribly overused and terribly misunderstood in the sector. And people oftentimes think collaboration means that you're going in arm in arm and you're making s'mores around the campfire and you're writing checks together. You know, collaboration can be as simple as, you know, Beth talked about having this weekly phone call of people and sharing information. That's a form of collaboration. And you're supporting each other in doing that. So you shouldn't be afraid of collaboration. You should just collaborate in a way that is comfortable for you and ultimately supports your mission, your community, your partners in what you're doing. This is often misunderstood. Beth or Michael, did you have any other comments on what we're talking about?
So I would just add in that as Henry knows, I'm a foodie, and I love to share my dining room table with lots of people. And I often think about how wonderful especially the family foundations are, and kitchen table philanthropy is a wonderful, beautiful thing. And so invite some new friends to your kitchen table, to your dining room table, and you'll find great conversation, and it will lead to really strong relationships that are going to be beneficial both to your organization and you and the communities and the causes that you serve collectively. And so that's how I would couch this opportunity that we have moving forward.
And if I could just add to that, Henry, I would say this, piggybacking off what Beth and Renee said, because we are a center for generosity and it's embedded in our culture, we truly do not care about who gets the credit in terms of who gives away the grant. So every single day we field calls from private foundations who say, we don't want to pass through you, we don't want to collaborate in terms of a pool to give the money away, but we do have knowledge to educate them on which nonprofits are making the needle move in our area. And if that's just a conversation that they want to have and to know that we can facilitate that conversation, because at the end of the day, if we can get help for the clients, those who are hungry, those who need the services, that's all we really care about. So I would say just reach out if it's just for a conversation.
Great. So before we wrap up the game show here, the lightning round, so just any one closing thought that you want to share with people as they go forth continue their funding, and we all continue to try and combat the impact of COVID-19 on our respective communities. Michael, how about you go first?
I'm actually going to wrap up what you just said. This work is not about us. And I think in the field of philanthropy, it's about the love of humanity. And the moment that we lose sight of this, I think we got to question whether or not why we're in this work. It's not about building our own fortress. It's really about the people that we're trying to help. What are we trying to solve? What are we trying to eradicate? What are we trying to improve? That's what it is all about for us in the field of philanthropy.
To which I would say amen, thank you. And Beth?
I would say I'm really worried about my communities. Rural North Central Washington, back when we've been also looking at 2008 and what happened. I've been around for a long time, and we're really concerned. And we're just going to try to do the best we can to leverage our dollars in a way that we can help the most people come through this in as intact as we can make it, and to move forward and live their lives in a great way.
Key word in that, you know, Beth said help the most people. It's not about helping the most nonprofits. It's about helping the most people. So that's just a piece of the puzzle. And Renee, a final thought.
Yeah, gratitude that all of you showed so much interest in what we're doing. I agree with Beth. This is a really difficult time for all of our communities. Your communities need you. So just never forget how important you are to them. And I think it's really important to keep hope alive in the sense that we've got to celebrate the good that we are doing and achieving while at the same time, you know, holding in tension all of the pain that there is and really ask ourselves, are we leveraging, are we magnifying, are we being vulnerable in a sense of allowing ourselves to let other people's pain penetrate enough that we're willing to take some risks to move beyond our comfort zone and maybe try to collaborate with others that we haven't collaborated with before, because together we can impact more lives. So it's really a moment, I think, for reflection, for risk-taking, and for allowing ourselves to both feel kind of grief and gratitude at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you, Renee. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Michael. Some great stuff. Before we sign off, again, I want to thank Madeline, who's always so wonderful, and my colleague, Brenda McCormick, who's always standing by for when Comcast decides it's my neighborhood's turn to lose its internet. I would also add, Brendan did a wonderful post that went up on our blog, I believe on Thursday, which had the results of a survey many of you completed about how people are addressing this crisis and in their funding. And there's a lot of great data in there to take a look at. So please do that. There was some pretty robust, I think, conversations going on in the chat room, which is great. I'd urge you to continue that in our discussion group online. Hope to see you all next week. Hope you stay safe, stay sane. Enjoy the weekend. And as always, wash your hands. Thanks.
Thank you.